Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
The Peter B. Collins Show is supported by great listeners, and I'd like to thank a few, including Andrew Krieger, Teresa Paris, Don Sisney, and Gail of Created by Gail. Thanks for voluntarily subscribing to this program. And if you would like to emulate them, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage is the link where you can grab a subscription for as little as $5 a month. Upcoming on today's podcast, a conservative. Hope you didn't fall out of your chair and have your earbuds wrapped around your neck. David Brooks, the conservative op-ed columnist for the New York Times, who is also a conservative op-ed voice on the PBS NewsHour, will join me in a moment. Will Durst's latest commentary will come up at the end of this podcast. And after we talk to David Brooks, I'm going to give you a list of the damage of the budget cuts that have been passed here in California, all on the backs of the poor. That's ahead today here on the Peter B. Collins Show. David Brooks, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us here at the Secret Studio. This is a secret location. So
I came in a hood. I was wondering why I couldn't tell.
Even if you knew where Dick Cheney's secret location is, I want you to treat this as sensitively as that. David Brooks writes for the New York Times on the op-ed page twice a week, right?
That's correct.
He is also the weekly conservative commentator on the PBS NewsHour, of which I'm a loyal viewer.
Thank you.
And his newest book is The Social Animal, The Hidden Source of Love, Character, and Achievement. And David, I just finished your book about 20 minutes before you got here, and I really appreciate what you've done here.
Oh, thank you.
And in the epilogue, you say that you took a chance, and I'd like you to know that your risk paid off.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
It worked. And what you have here is a fictional narrative featuring Harold and Erica, two characters that you've created. We get to meet their parents, understand their backgrounds, and see how they evolve through life. And the narrative is punctuated by your commentaries at different points. And it strikes me that this is all of the stuff that you're fascinated by that doesn't fit into your political writing. And I wonder how long this stuff was percolating and in what form? Sticky notes, clippings, books laid around a table?
The world of politics is important, but it happens more or less on the surface of life. And most of the stuff that really matters is beneath the surface, the things like emotions, relationships, culture, just how we think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always been sort of fascinated by the understructure of life and mm-hmm. how I wanted to take the research of the past 30 years and put it into one story. And I wanted to create characters because I'm not really good at thinking of in abstractions. I need examples. And by creating characters, I could show how a lot of this research played out in real life. And one of the challenges of the book was to get all this different research from neuroscience, cognitive science, behavioral economics into one story and to meld it together. And it was really to organize a lot of the research. And I confess, the way I did it was through Kinko's. I read hundreds and hundreds of books, talked to hundreds and hundreds of scientists. But how to organize it all, so I would read the books, I was underlined, mm-hmm. and then I would go to Kinko's and I would Xerox it.
Uh-huh.
And then I would arrange the pages and the studies in different folders. And that's how I sort of structured the thing.
Yeah. I'm a sticky notes guy. As you can see,
I
attacked your book. I'm not even sure what color this is, but it's
salmon,
pinkish.
Maybe, yeah.
But there's a lot of remarkable info that's worth bookmarking. And don't take this the wrong way, but this shows a depth to David Brooks that I did not pick up from your political writings or from, you know, what do you get, 5 minutes a week on the NewsHour?
Right. So, you know, a lot of it is how we fall in love, things like that. I don't really get to write about that in the newspaper. How we choose a mate, how we make friends, what leads to happiness and fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that are not the normal stuff of politics. And I think things that we're generally not that great at talking about in our culture, I think we're really good at talking about material things, not so great at talking about what really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a pleasure to be able to do that and really answer problems that I had in life.
Does this cause any problems with your conservative friends? Because it's touchy, it's feely, it's compassionate. It reflects worldviews other than your own.
I don't think it does. I think we all have emotions, and a lot of this is beneath politics.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things it does is it reminds you that we're not sort of rational utilitarian creatures all the time. We have, especially in the world of policymaking, we rely on economists who tell us that we're sort of these rational individuals who respond in straightforward ways to incentives. And yet we just had a financial crisis where we had most of the world bankers en masse behaving in completely irrational and stupid ways. So why did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, really the thing that got me into the book was I was trying to figure out why did 20 or 30% of kids drop out of high school? And why are we so bad at helping them complete high school?
You can't escape the policy stuff entirely.
No, well, it sort of started with that, but then it took off. And when you start doing that, you get into the relationships with mom.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists can take a look at a kid's relationship with mom at 18 months, and they can predict with 77% accuracy if that kid's going to graduate from high school. Because some kids come into the school or come into life knowing how to build relationships, knowing how to download information, knowing how to communicate. Mm-hmm. And if you grow up in a home where you learn to do that, you're just going to have a huge leg up. Another bit of research, a very famous bit of research I really relied upon very early in the process, was Walter Mischel's marshmallow experiment, which is one of the most charming and famous experiments, where he took four-year-olds, put them in a room, and gave them a marshmallow and said, you can come back. I'm going to come back in 10 minutes, and if you haven't eaten this marshmallow, I'll give you two marshmallows. And some kids could wait 8, 10, 12 minutes, and they don't eat the marshmallows. Some kids pop it right in their mouth.
Right.
And the kids who can wait 20 years later have much higher college completion rates, and 30 years later, much higher incomes. The kids who can't wait have much higher drug and alcohol addiction problems, much higher incarceration rates. And so these are the things that go beneath economics. Are you able to control yourself? Are you able to look at the world in an astute and perceptive way?
It's beneath
IQ even.
Please describe the Oreo version of that test and the laugh line you wrote.
Yeah, well, when Mischel showed me the videos of the kids trying not to eat the marshmallows, one little girl is literally banging her head on the table trying to eat the marshmallow. Another, a guy is shoving the marshmallow up his nose trying to at least smell the thing. But one day, Mischel was using an Oreo cookie, and the kid carefully picks up the Oreo, carefully eats out the middle, and then carefully puts the Oreo back. And my joke is that kid is now a U.S. senator.
But no names are names.
No names.
David, before we meet Harold and Erica, the characters who drive this the story and the various issues that you raise, there are two things that really jumped out at me. And I think it'll give people a flavor for the exploration that you present here. And the first is about imagination.
Right.
What are the causes of imagination? What are the triggers that allow us to operate in this other world that is somewhat connected to reality, but depending on our own abilities, can take us far from it?
Right. Well, we think of things like, if I ask you to find the door in this room, we think, oh, that's a very simple thing. I can easily find the door in any room. And we think problems like how do you get the square root of 568 is a very hard problem. But any computer could do the square root. No computer could find the door. Because finding a door requires you to be able to create a gist to know essentially what doors are.
Mm-hmm.
And so any four-year-old can pretend to be a tiger, can say, I am a tiger. And that seems so simple. We can all do that. But in reality, taking a complicated thing, I, and a complicating thing, tiger, and blending them together is just phenomenally difficult and phenomenally taxing. But that is what creativity is. What Picasso did was take the concept Western art and the concept African masks. And he blended those two idea spaces together to create a third thing. And not only the geometry, but the moral systems. And so when we create, when we have imagination, some people have the ability to create a gist and to combine gists together to create a new third thing. And that's phenomenally complicated, but something we're blessed with unconsciously.
Mm-hmm. And do some people have greater powers than others? Is there such a thing as an aura? And are some humans better able to read them than others?
Yeah, and I think some of it is by genetics, but some of it is by nature. It's by nurture, by the way we live our lives. Some people can look out over a scene, and they're just very perceptive about what they see there. In my newspaper, I had a story, which I refer to in the book, about soldiers in Baghdad who could look down a street and to tell whether there was an IED, a bomb, somewhere in the street. And when they were asked, how do you know? They could say, well, I can't really tell you, but I feel a coldness.
Yeah.
And that's because of certain, because they've worked so hard to study, consciously they couldn't tell you what feels wrong, but something feels wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a perceptiveness that you get really through practice.
Mm-hmm. The other concept that you commented on, and I put it into the Bush lexicon, is, I have to get my note out here to get it correct. Misoverestimate.
Yeah.
Because you write about overconfidence, and Bush was famous for his misunderestimate
right.
comment.
Right.
And this is something that I think many people wrestle with, because for me, fundamentally, confidence, self-esteem is 80% of the game.
Right.
That, you know, and this is something I credit my parents with. I don't see it as ego-based. But the ability to believe in oneself is an essence that makes you competitive, that makes you really a player. And yet you cite the issues of people who go too far.
Right. So you should have a little slightly inflated self-esteem. And actually, guys are really good at this. If you ask people what your IQ is, guys will overestimate their IQ by about 10%. On average, women tend to be accurate. And actually, it's useful to be a little overestimate. But you don't want to go too far. And so we have a tendency to be wildly overconfident. So 96% of college professors think they have above average teaching skills, and they can't all be right. And so I say some researchers who asked executives in different industries, they gave them tests about their own industry. And advertising people, they gave them tests and they said, how confident are you? You know a lot about your industry. You got the test. The answer is right. And advertising executives were confident they got 80% of the answers right. In fact, they got 60% wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Computer executives were the most overconfident. And this is a male-related trait. So men drown at twice the rate of women because men have great faith in their ability to swim, especially after they've been drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things one should do is it's important to have what the scientists call metacognition, the ability to look inside yourself and detect your own weaknesses. And if you know you have a weakness toward overconfidence, you can build modesty bootstraps for yourselves. And one of my favorites was Peter Drucker had one. He said, every time you make a decision, write it down, your decision and your reasoning, seal it in an envelope, open it in 9 months. And you'll find that a third of your decisions were right, a third were wrong, a third were in the middle. But in most cases, your reasoning will be irrelevant.
Huh.
And if you read those notes to yourself, you'll be reminded, well, I'm not all that smart. And when I make decisions, I should be aware that I'm probably not as smart as I think I am.
The other thing that fascinated me, the evidence you presented, was that Democrats overstated the rate of inflation during the Reagan years, and Republicans understated a key figure from the Clinton era.
Unemployment, yeah.
Unemployment.
So this is, when we perceive the world, sometimes we think it's a very clear process. We just look at the world and it comes in through our eyes. But in actuality, we're creating a world when we perceive it. And we tend to perceive things more powerfully that make us feel good. And so Democrats didn't want to think well of Reagan. So when asked, did inflation go down under Reagan, which it objectively did, they said, no, inflation went up under Reagan. And similarly, when Republicans were asked, did unemployment go down under Clinton, which it objectively did, they said, no, unemployment went up.
Mm-hmm. What about deficits?
That's
a whole other area of Enron accounting, isn't it?
Right. So and there, I'm sure it's the same. And the point is we tend to pick the facts, they call it confirmation bias,
mm-hmm.
that make us feel good. And so that's another flaw you have to really be to watch out for in yourself. So in some cases, the unconscious is incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it has some weaknesses. And so understanding both those things are important to leading a good life.
And isn't what you describe part of what drives the Fox News phenomenon, that people want their own set of facts? And I'm more of an MSNBC viewer.
Right.
And it does alienate me at times when I feel they're just pandering to me.
Right, but that's the sure way to build ratings, I guess.
But we're now a nation that has at least two sets of facts on almost every controversy.
Yeah, at least two, and sometimes the two don't meet at any point.
Yeah.
And so one of the keys to, as I say, to leading a successful life is what I call equipoise. Do you have the serenity and the self-confidence, really, to say, yeah, I think I know what's true, but I also have to check myself so I don't ruin myself with my own confirmation biases. I have to hear opposing views. And I think if you approach life with that sense of modesty, then you say, well, I probably need people on the other side. I need the conversation. Because if it was just up to me, I'd probably get things wrong. I'd take things to extreme. I need other people to balance me. And so that's why we need conversations. We need political dialogue.
Introduce our listeners to Harold and Erica, your two key figures who are essentially the vehicles for your exploration.
Right. Harold is a popular high school kid, a football player, who's maybe a little charming and maybe skirts by on charm, but he's very good at picking up social cues. But he has in the course of the book, he deepens himself a little and can't get by with charm. And one of the episodes that happens in his life is he runs across a fantastic teacher. And she detects sort of a spiritual longing in him, and she hands him a series of books on Greek history. And the Greeks had a series of words that we've lost on how to deepen yourself and some of the essential drives of human nature. One of them is the thymotic urge, the desire for recognition. We all want to be recognized in life. We want glory, and we want to be admired, not only now, but in the future by our offspring. And so through having a great teacher and a relationship with a teacher, he becomes a more serious person. The woman, Erica, starts out very poor. Her dad is a Mexican-American. Her mom's Chinese-American, and they're separate. Her mom suffers from depression. And when Erica is about 8 or 10, she has to send her mom to an institution. She has to survive on her own, get bologna from the bodega to survive, tell her friends that her mom has asthma because she doesn't want to admit what's happening at home. But she has a key insight, which is really confirmed by the research, is that we don't have the power to change our own minds, but we do have the power to choose the circumstances. And by choosing an environment, we change what happens to our mind. So she more or less forces herself into a KIPP academy, a charter school. And this is one of these schools where they teach kids to walk with discipline down the corridor, to nod when people are talking to them, to look people in the eye. It gives them a structure. And at the moment in her life when things are really spiraling out of control, she inserts herself into a place that gives her structure and allows her to build an organized existence. And one of the really key findings of the research is that New Year's resolutions don't work because we can't change our minds by force of will. But if you change your behavior, then you can change your mind. As the folks at Alcoholics Anonymous put it, you fake it till you make it. And so she has the power to change her behavior and that way really restructure her own mind, and she becomes a very ambitious and very successful person, filled with a relentless drive.
Two things about Erica. One is I felt the charter school part was a little thick. I'm not totally opposed to charter schools, but it's a mixed bag to me, and we have problems here in California with mismanagement and profiteering at charter schools, which is not part of the mission. I just give credit. My parents sent me to a Jesuit high school.
Yeah.
And so I kind of read that into it as I was, picking up your cues about the charter school, because I'm very grateful. They provided me with a framework, taught me how to think, taught me how to ask questions, and they would probably not think I'm their greatest success story, but I'm very proud of what they gave me.
Right.
And I do think that religious schools, some private schools, and some amazing public schools today do deliver some of the same messages and growth opportunities that go well beyond just the book learning.
Right. I agree with that. The charter schools, some are good, some are bad. The schools I really model this after are called KIPP Academies, and I think they tend to be good. But one of the things that's really underlined in the book is the parts that are in the curriculum of a school are important. But most of what we remember from our teachers is a way of being in the world. And we emulate teachers not only for what they teach us, but for how they are, how they think. And I think a lot of schools, like the Jesuit schools in particular, give you a way of thinking, a way of approaching the world. They also are confident about talking about character. And one of the things I have problems with in many parts of society is we're good at talking about money, but we're not so good at talking about character. And in many institutions, they don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm. And one of my problems is that character is being defined by the religious right in this country in a way that alienates many who are non-believers or lukewarm believers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I respect that religious values, including those, you know, far more evangelical or fundamental than mine, can provide people with a very important framework. It's when they try to foist it on others that I start to recoil.
Right, and I think the research, the version of character that I was at least confirmed by in the research is that just saying no doesn't work. If you just say, no, I'm not going to do that, I'll exercise iron willpower and I won't do this, that doesn't work. But what Aristotle had it right, which is to say, what we learn character by building up habits and etiquette. And if you build up habits of self-restraint, of selflessness in the small things, when the big temptations come along, you'll have the mental grooves to sort of resist the big temptations. So it's everyday actions of kindness and of self-discipline that really build big character later on.
One of the other parts of the book that really rang true and again made me respect you in new ways was that you let Erica fail.
Yeah.
That she had a huge setback and then had to go to work for a corporation where she wasn't particularly happy. And I appreciate that because if it had just been a kind of, you know, happy mythology, it wouldn't have had the same connection. But I think that you put it in a very contemporary context of the current recession and how many people's own businesses got shut down as a result. And the hard choices that they had to make in following that. Right. So I think that's an important wrinkle of the story, and I again thought you did very well there.
Thank you. Yeah, no, she suffers that business failure. She suffers a personal failure. She commits adultery and is ashamed of it. And goes to the point of resilience, which is so important, and the ability just to fight through things. One of the things, you know, emotion really matters, but that doesn't mean it's squishy. You have to be mentally tough as well. And one of the things the research shows is that the people who do well in life, they fail. They learn from failure, but they keep working. And the ability just to work hard day after day is just tremendously powerful. That I mentioned in the book a tennis camp where they play for 6 months without a ball. They just swing rackets slowly. A music camp where they play music so slowly that if you can recognize the song, you're playing too fast. Hmm. And they call that deliberate practice. And it's that kind of deliberate practice over and over again that leads to excellence.
Yeah.
And it's not fun, but it actually does pay off.
Two little questions. There's a reference in there to Vladimir Putin stealing somebody's ring and not giving it back.
Right.
Is that true?
That is true. It happened. It's been publicly reported. It happened to Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots.
Uh-huh.
And he told me that story. It's been published in the press, so I sort of adapted it for some things are too rich that you can't make up.
Well, it was new to me, and I got a kick out of that because just today it was revealed that his boy, Medvedev has for the first time publicly disagreed with Putin over Libya, and I think that is signal, isn't it?
I hope so. You know, it's really, I covered the decline of the Soviet Union. It was a big influence on my life.
Yeah.
And the fact that really everything in that society was stolen. It's a sign of the lack of social trust there, and that the kleptocracy, the fact that it even extended to a Super Bowl ring from a visiting American businessman, shows you the mentality and the importance, by the way, of social trust in shaping how we live unconsciously. One of the bits of research I have in the book concerns diplomats in New York City who they had immunity to really to break the law, park wherever they wanted.
Sure, yeah. They do it here, too.
Oh, sure. But somebody had the bright idea to do a study and say people from which country are breaking the law most often. And they found the diplomats who parked illegally the most tended to be from the countries that had the highest corruption levels back home.
Mm.
So I think the Kuwaitis were number one, 267 parking tickets per diplomat, whereas some of the countries with very low corruption levels, like Sweden, zero parking tickets per diplomat because they just have inherited certain social norms, and that's how they're going to behave. I'm Swedish. I'm not going to park in front of the fire hydrant.
Yeah. This is a friendly correction. I have been to the birthplace of Alexander Hamilton, and it is on the island of Nevis, not St. Croix, as you
did
mentioned
in the
book. Did
I say St. Croix in that book?
You did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. I didn't. I think I knew that. But
fire a fact checker.
Okay. I'm embarrassed about that, but I appreciate that. I thought I knew that. But,
if you ever have a chance, Nevis is a beautiful little island.
Yeah. I'm a big Hamiltonian, and I've read about him, and I've read Ron Chernow's fabulous biography of him.
Uh-huh.
But I've never been there. I should go.
Yeah.
I should go.
Well, I'm a sailor, and I've been to the Caribbean many times. Mm-hmm. And Nevis and St. Kitts are paired together. They're former British possessions. And they're both neat little places with their own character, worth visiting.
I certainly associate Hamilton with Nevis and not St. Croix, but who knows? Sometimes I write things and I don't understand why I did them.
Blame the word processor or somebody. David Brooks with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And his new book is The Social Animal. It's also available as an audiobook published by Random House. And I recommend it. I really found it fascinating and rewarding to read. David, I want to shift now to politics because that's your main line of work. And as I said, I'm a regular viewer of the PBS NewsHour. And I'm wondering, I know you're not the producer or an editor there. You're just a hired hand. But do you share my perception that it is the best television newscast available in America today? And still, it has serious shortcomings. It pains me that Margaret Warner traveled maybe 12 days last year to foreign locations, that all of your coverage from the Middle East right now and from Japan is from ITN, that there are no PBS correspondents who can be dispatched to these very critical news sites.
Right. Well, Margaret travels a lot. Ray Suarez travels a lot. But the fact is we have financial pressures, and so we have to rely on ITN. I think they do a good job, but you know, I guess I can be free to say that it would be better if we had correspondents there, but we're viewer supported.
Do you think more federal money would help?
Well, I think more money would help. The prospect that we're going to get more federal money right now is so beyond the realm of possibility that I haven't really thought about that. But it would be nice if we had more money to, because we do have a significant number of viewers.
Yeah.
And it's just, believe me, it is a show run on a shoestring. There's no waste. When you go to our studios in Shirlington, Virginia, they're in a very unimpressive industrial area.
Mm-hmm.
We're not very paid very well.
Yeah.
So we're using all the money we have. But sending people abroad is really expensive because you can't just send the correspondent. Obviously, you have to send a crew. And it's expensive, but it would be worth doing.
Now, you do pledge pitches for the local stations, but not for the program itself. And I would be willing to subscribe to the PBS NewsHour if you want to just pass that along.
That's a good idea.
Short of a TV tax, that's one way I think you could get more money without the expansion of that commercial block at the beginning of the show.
Right, right.
I
don't know. If I ever understood the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the various public broadcasting networks, I'd be a genius. It's really complicated. So I don't know why we don't do individual show fundraising.
Now, I do talking head interviews, so I'm not opposed to talking heads, even on television.
Right.
But the heads that are chosen are from such a narrow scope, and they fed me a great example last night. It was Bignev Brzezinski and Brent Scowcroft debating our current adventures in Libya.
Yeah.
And they do happen to have a slight disagreement on the issues,
right?
But that doesn't offer me a robust range of opinion on a very critical problem. And I don't believe the issue was raised about war powers. And I consider that to be a very significant point of discussion. Republicans and Democrats alike are challenging the president's launch of this military action without consultation.
Right.
First, to my point about the talking heads, would you agree that we could use more diversity there of both opinion and people from outside the Beltway?
I guess so, though I would say two things. One, people have done studies of who has how many people from which camp have which voices and how much time, and then everything's going to be flawed, but I would say the NewsHour does better than most individual shows.
You don't have John McCain on nearly as often as Meet the Press does.
Well, no, he's a favorite on Meet the Press, that's for sure.
He's number one.
I'm also under contract with Meet the Press, so I have to be careful about that. But and let me say about Scowcroft and Brzezinski, on the one hand, I agree they're not too far apart. On the other hand, they both are serious foreign policy thinkers, and I, for one, would be interested to see what they how they debated, though they do not clearly represent the range of American political opinion. But, you know, they're both very brilliant, interesting people who've had senior administration roles. And so we could always do better. But I don't know. I'd ask you, can you think of another show that has as much diversity as the NewsHour compared to the other shows that are out there?
Well, because it's bifurcated now,
right.
You get, you know, some, you know, valid viewpoints from the left on MSNBC, and you get
right.
some great commentators on Fox. I do
right.
watch Fox occasionally.
Right. Right.
But we don't really have a commons
right.
Where you can go and hear the full range.
Yeah,
and to me, that's the service that the PBS NewsHour, with or without government funding, needs to provide in an era when ratings-driven, research-driven reporting right. is dominating broadcast news.
Right. And I agree, and I think the producers do their best, and they think about this quite a lot. And the one thing I like about the NewsHour is they don't always get the typical talking heads. They don't get the people with full, rich heads of hair. If you look at me, I don't have that. But they get academics sometimes.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're not the most polished individuals in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But they have the substance.
Yeah.
And so that's a virtue.
So what is your position about Libya and war powers?
Yeah, I was more or less thinking we should do something simply because I didn't want to see humanitarian disaster. And I think also, this is a unique moment in the history of the Middle East, and if we can help the tides of democracy, that would be a good thing. The more I've seen the exact operation, the more troubled I am, and mostly because I'm not sure we've thought it through. I'm not sure what our goals are. I'm not sure who the Libyan opposition is. I spoke to a friend who's over there, and he gave me some troubling reports. Of
That's
some
a
of the
big issue for me.
Met.
Who
yeah.
follows?
Right.
No, we create a vacuum, and then what?
Right. And I
we clearly aren't ready to occupy Libya, and that's a relief.
Right. And so if he said some of the people in the opposition are sort of impressive, some are deeply not, some are delusional. And so I'm not sure we've thought that through.
It's a tribal nation, and Gaddafi has managed to suppress the rival tribes, much in the way that, you know, Mubarak decimated any opposition
right.
in Egypt. So
right.
in every case, this idea of the tide of freedom, we have to hope for low tide in some places like Bahrain, right?
right?
Because of the complications of Iran to its east and yeah. its sharp ties to Saudi Arabia, which has now parked a couple of thousand troops there just to remind us of what side they're on.
Right. Though I guess I would say I do think these authoritarian regimes are unstable. 85 authoritarian regimes have failed in the last 20 or 30 years. So banking our hopes on these kind of governments is a risky thing to do.
But taking on the Saudis is equally risky.
No, absolutely, yeah. But I do
think we owe them a lot of money. We get a lot of oil.
Right. Yeah, though I do think if we're going to have, over the long run, a stable Middle East, and look at how many times we've been sort of dragged into the Arab world in the last few years, I do think there has to be some. They have to enjoy the openness revolutions that have swung through Latin America, through Asia, through Europe. Somehow we have to move in that direction. And the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt were a sign that there's some movement there. And so I think we should do what we can to help. I just, you know, even going back to Libya, a no-fly zone, you can have a no-fly zone and people can still get massacred.
Yeah.
And it's happened before. And you know, I think we learned in the 90s that just lobbing a few missiles into a country doesn't mean you're really fundamentally changing things.
Well, and even Gaddafi can read the message that nobody wants to send ground troops in there.
Right. And he's been quite resilient, and we've really given him no alternative but to be resilient. We've more or less said fight to the death.
Mm-hmm.
And then so he's doing so. And so, you know, I'm sort of very anxious about the way this thing has been organized.
David, 2/3 of Americans in a recent poll, and that includes many Republicans, oppose our continued presence in Afghanistan. Do you still support that deployment, and do you think we have any bright prospects?
Yeah, I haven't been there for about a year or so, so I'm less confident than I was. When I was there last time, like about a year ago, you know, I met with people from the UN, I met with the NGOs, I met with our military people, and they were still pretty committed and pretty optimistic. And I asked them, especially compared to Iraq, how does this feel? Does it feel like it's something worth doing and is doable. And they were still, they thought it was a much more promising situation than Iraq. They liked the Afghans better. They thought their relationships with the Afghans were better. They thought the social fabric was better. And so that was maybe a year, 18 months ago. And so I came back from that trip thinking it was worth doing.
Pardon me, but social fabric, Afghanistan?
Yeah, at the local level. They do have village elders. They do have these shura, these councils. And so that's what I was told. And the villages, you know, when you fly over Afghanistan, it's like a green valley and a village. And then you fly for 60 miles of rugged Rocky Mountains and then another green valley and a village. And so within each village, there's some sort of structure there, village elders.
But there's no history of a network of building larger communities. And the overarching history is of warlords with shifting allegiances to wherever the money is flowing from at a given time.
Right. No, there's certainly that, and that's been borne out by the corruption levels in Afghanistan. So I'm less confident than I was, mostly because I haven't been, and I've sort of been shaken by a fellow Random House author, a guy named Bing West, who I admire, and he's just has a book come out, and he's very down on the Afghan campaign. And he says, you know, he spent 3 years with Marines there, and he said the villages are not fundamentally changing the way that we need them to change. And so he's more pessimistic, and I've sort of been shaken by what he's come back and told me.
As a liberal, let me ask you to contrast Bush's wars with what are now Obama's wars, because I was one of those people outspoken against Bush, and I had a lot of Democratic companions at the time, right. Elected leaders. They have gone silent. Many of them are still against the war, and Barbara Lee, to her credit, continues to introduce bills that get no Democratic support to end the deployments in Afghanistan. And I developed a concept. You know, Reagan was the Teflon president. Well, I think DuPont created a new and improved product called Leflon for Obama.
Yeah.
And nothing that supported him from the left as he ran for office and won the presidency matters anymore. He flicks off the complaints from progressives and liberals as he cozies up to the military and to conservatives who continue to kick him in the shins.
right. Well,
so I'm just curious how you view this, you know, given my perspective, that I'm very disappointed that the same people who were full-throated against these wars when Bush was president are stunningly silent today.
Yeah. Well, I'd say a lot of people are driven primarily by partisanship and not by beliefs, and they're not going to attack a president of their own party, and that's true of Republicans and Democrats. I also would say of Obama that he is a center-left, more establishment figure. I never thought he was particularly left-wing. A lot of my conservative friends thought he was very left-wing. I never really particularly thought that. I thought he was very establishment-oriented. I never thought he was going to, you know, he's really been influenced by Secretary Gates and Secretary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the course of, say, the decision to increase our commitment to Afghanistan, I think he came into that debate not wanting to do it. But after Clinton and Gates formed a united front, he really turned in their direction. I don't know how sincere it was. I do know politically, and I really don't know how much political considerations affect these decisions. I do know he thinks that people on the left will be with him, will vote for him, and that he's got to worry, spend the next 2 years worrying about independent voters. And that's clearly what he's been doing on issue after issue.
Do you think he should be involved in the disputes in Madison and other capitals regarding workers' rights?
You know, I guess that's a tough one. Again, when he goes into, say, the Madison dispute, he did it in a way that was tried to be all things to all people, I would say. Mm-hmm. I wasn't crazy about what the governor did in Madison. I think we do need to cut spending. I think we need to rein in pensions.
But I heard you with Shields, at least not in a strong or aggressive way, but making the point that you think that public employee unions cost too much money.
I do think that, but I do think just as a political strategy, when we're going to reduce deficits, everyone has to suffer, that we need to spread the burden around to every interest groups. And the thing I objected to with Governor Walker was that only the people who were his political opponents were suffering. He wasn't asking anything of his own people. I don't think that's a long-term strategy for the size of debt we have. So I do think some of the public sector unions are going to have to scale back some of the pension promises that have been made to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that businesses and other Republican groups are going to have to take a hit too, just to make it fair. And that's
and
one
I'm
of my
waiting.
Principles.
I'm waiting, David Brooks. Yeah. I share that opinion. I wanted to raise that today because as I read your book, you're talking about the critical aspects of early childhood development. In the case of Erica, she grew up poor, and you don't describe a lot of contact with government services, but I can infer that. Right. And here in California, the Republicans continue to exercise minority rule. They wouldn't vote for any of the budget cuts that the Democrats have put through, and they are more loyal to Governor Norquist than they are to the people of California. Right. And so last week, the state legislature cut $150 million from that will raise the copays for poor people when they go to the hospital, 10% reduction in all long-term care, 10% reduction in what they pay to physicians who see Medi-Cal patients. And I won't bore you with this whole list, but you can see it laid out in the San Francisco Chronicle here. Right. There isn't one cut or increase that affects business, that affects the wealthy. This is all on the backs of the poor. Right. And I think that, you know, we're creating a new class of criminals. We're creating a new class of underachievers, of people who will have to be carried by the rest of us in one form or another, whether we pay their big bills at the emergency room or pay up front for Medi-Cal.
Right.
And so this drive by Republican ideologues to shrink government, regardless of its impact on the most vulnerable, just it strikes me as so cold and calculating. And it's hard for me to connect your writings in The Social Animal with any embrace of these hardline tactics.
Yeah, well, I think I've been very upfront about the way I balance budgets. And I've written many columns on this and talked about it on the air. And that is essentially we need to make affluent seniors pay more. And we have this giant money machine which transfers money from young, poorer families to affluent seniors. And we've got to reduce some of the benefits that go to the affluent seniors, and we're probably going to have to raise taxes on them. And when we make our cuts, we've got to, A, spread the pain fairly across all sectors, B, cut on consumption and invest in investment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would, you know, I've written that my problem with the Obama budget, that he didn't really cut deficits enough, but the things they got right was they continued to spend and spent a little even more on early childhood education and then some of the stuff that clearly pays off in the long run. And so I would take some of the Republican desire to cut overall, which I think we need to do, but I would marry it with some of the Obama things, which they do where they say, well, let's evaluate programs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not just cut the stuff that has the least political influence. Let's cut the stuff that's not working. And I think the Obama budget office is doing a much better job of that than the Republicans. I just wish they were more ambitious in what they were trying to do so we could have a long-term fiscal sustainability.
Both sides keep defense off the table. I think that's untenable.
Well, Secretary Gates is willing to cut it a bit.
A bit.
A bit. And so
a jet engine here, but it's not substantial. He's not talking about, I want to cut back $100 billion in the next 5 years.
Right. You know, and I'm not an expert on this. I personally am not sure why we need as many carrier groups as we have. Some of the naval things, I don't see them being used all that much. I could be wrong. But I think the money is in healthcare, and unless we get healthcare under control, and we probably, you know, our tax revenues are, well, they fell to about 15% of our economy, but they probably have to be around 19 or 20%, which probably means a little tax increase, maybe rolling back some of the Bush tax cuts. But we need both.
Mm-hmm.
And we probably need to just do a big tax reform, maybe taxing consumption more, simplifying the tax code. As a way to raise a little more revenue.
Maybe collecting corporate taxes. We don't have to raise them.
Yeah, I guess on that, I do think that's one area where every other government is undercutting us on corporate tax rates, and it is creating a competitive disadvantage for us. So I'm not sure I'd raise corporate taxes, but I might raise income taxes. I would certainly get rid of a lot of the tax loopholes that the corporations enjoy right now.
Mm-hmm. David, what is your take on Obama in terms of civil liberties? I'm very troubled that the wiretapping that Bush launched that was euphemistically called warrantless wiretapping,
right,
is now legalized by the FISA reforms of 2008. They gave immunity to the phone companies. There are only two cases now that have been found to have standing to even challenge this widespread collection of our phone calls and emails. And I just want a fundamental return to the Fourth Amendment, probable cause and a warrant before you can tap my phone.
Yeah. Well, first, I should say that there are many different subjects, and I'm not an expert in all of them. This is one I haven't written about. And so I spent a lot of time on education, healthcare, and all those other issues. I don't have enough brain space for these issues. I would only observe that the second Bush term and the first Obama term look extremely similar.
They sure do.
On all these subjects.
Yeah. And what about detention, the closure of Guantanamo?
Yeah, it was interesting talking to people in the Obama administration, people in the Bush administration. In the second Bush administration, they said, you know, we wanted to close it, but we couldn't figure out what to replace it with. And so we couldn't announce the closure until we had a replacement. And then I remember the day that Obama announced the closure without having a replacement, I talked to some Bush people, and they said, we never thought of that. We should have just announced we were going to close it without any replacement, which is essentially what Obama's done. But they still don't have a really replacement for the thing.
But wasn't that eerily like Clinton's day one of gays in the military, where members of his own party, notably Sam Nunn, just lowered the boom on him? And if we have to wait 18 years to close Guantanamo, and I'm just day one as the reason, that's a really sad commentary.
Yeah, I wonder if it's still I'd be interested to know if it's still a global issue, maybe, because it became, I think many people, like John McCain, thought it should be closed for a little while simply because it wasn't worth the damage to our reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what to do with the people who are still there is nobody seems to want them, and so that's just a practical problem.
Yeah. David, I know you need to go and head off to another interview. Just my final question is about the GOP field for president in 2012. You wrote a column, and Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, was on the NewsHour the next day. Mm-hmm. You looked a little embarrassed by that, but you're urging him to run. Is that an endorsement or just an archetype?
Yeah, I don't endorse. They don't need me to endorse, and my standing in Republican politics is not high enough to do any good for anybody. But I do admire him. I do think the Republicans could do a lot worse. I think he's been an effective manager. I'm sort of impressed with just the raw things he's done. I mean, at the Department of Motor Vehicles, they used to wait an hour to get your license renewed. Now it's down to about 7 minutes. I'm sort of impressed by that. And I think the Republicans would do well to say, okay, we can't match Obama in eloquence and brilliance, but we have a guy who might be a little boring, but he can get things done. I think that's a good message for these days. And so I think Daniels has been just a good, competent manager. The field itself, I don't think it's a particularly powerful field. If Obama's voted out, it will simply be an anti-Obama vote, but I don't think it's really going to be a pro-Pawlenty vote or a pro-Romney vote.
And you deserve credit for being a Republican not afraid to criticize Sarah Palin.
Yeah, no, very early on, I never had much taste for her, in part because, not anything personal against her, but people in government who really succeed love government. You got to love government, not just politics. You got to love the actual substance of government. And I never really saw much evidence, and I still don't see any evidence that she loves the substance of government.
Mm-hmm. Her trip to Israel, does that encourage you in terms of her broadening knowledge on foreign policy?
Well, maybe, but I'm sort of stunned. I mean, it's the sort of thing you do if you are running for president. But I really am surprised she's still thinking of that, because the polls among Republican primary voters are not good. And maybe she thinks she can turn it around, but I'm a little dubious she can.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you for spending time with us today. You are behind enemy lines here on the left coast. You came from the Pacifica station in Berkeley, and you seem unbent and unbruised.
I like to talk to everybody, so I'm fine. I'm
all
happy.
Right. Great to see you. Thanks
thank
for coming
you.
By. And one of the characteristics that David Brooks talks about in The Social Animal is called the Wanderer. Here's Johnny Cash with U2, a song of that name.
I went out walking through streets paved with gold. Lifted some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking under an atomic sky, where the ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye.
Yeah, I went with nothing, nothing but the thought of you. I went wandering.
And I do recommend David Brooks' book, The Social Animal, even if you do agree with him. But if you don't agree with his political commentaries, I think it's quite a departure from the persona that you're familiar with. And there's a lot of interesting descriptions of human behavior and human emotions. And again, I say this without trying to be condescending. It did give me a real appreciation for the depth of a man like David Brooks. He is not just the former Weekly Standard editor who spouts conservative talking points. And I wanted to expand a little bit about part of our discussion toward the end as we shifted from the book to current events and politics, because I give Brooks credit for being rational about the current budget problems that we have, and noting that they cannot all be corrected through cuts. And here in California, it pains me to say that a Democratic governor named Jerry Brown and a Democratic legislature that now has the authority to pass a budget with only 51% of both houses, up until last year it required two-thirds, and that gave the Republicans even more power as an obstructionist minority. And even though David Brooks is not the fire-breathing, knuckle-dragging, Neanderthal right-winger, he is a part of the party that is ramming through these cuts at great cost to human beings, the most vulnerable among us. And particularly for those who don't live in California, I would like you to know what's going on here because it gives me great pain. Now, Jerry Brown is not Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman was the Republican candidate for governor last year who spent $160 million, mostly her own fortune, from running eBay, where she generated over $1 billion for herself. Jerry Brown is doing much the same as what Meg Whitman would have done. The big difference is Whitman says she was going to try to pass a ban on dividend tax, on capital gains, here in California, and she personally would have benefited immensely from that. She wouldn't have had the votes in the current legislature to get it through anyway. So it's fair to say that with little exception, Jerry Brown is doing the dirty work that Meg Whitman was eager to do. And we have this bizarre sequence of events where the Democrats have voted for the budget cuts I'm about to list for you. And in most cases, no Republicans voted for any of these measures, even ones that Brown had served up trying to woo them over to his side, like defunding the redevelopment agencies across the state and taking that money into Sacramento and into local governments. That was a natural for the Republicans, and yet I believe only one member of the legislature on the Republican side voted for that. So we have this ugly scenario where the Democrats are negotiating with themselves to cut state services to those who need it the most, to those who are the core base of the Democratic Party. And I know enough of these legislators to know that they don't like it one bit. They don't relish this. They don't want to do it. But they feel they have no choice. And at the height of this struggle, as the deadline approaches and is almost passing, to get ballot measures on for a June initiative election, the Republicans held their state convention, and who did they bring in but Grover Norquist, holding Republican feet to the fire, threatening to recall any Republican who even supports putting tax extensions on the ballot. They don't have to support the tax extension themselves, but if they support allowing voters to choose, then they are subject to a right-wing-driven recall. And so with no Republican votes, even on the budget cuts, the Democrats are doing all the dirty work. They'll pay a political price for it to some extent. And the Republicans don't give an inch. They don't offer any kind of sacrifice for their constituent groups, corporations, and the wealthy. It is all greed-driven, and it makes Darwin and Charles Dickens seem like warm, loving, sensitive human beings. And I have to just tell you how distressed I am to see this going on in California, knowing what it will cost us long term. Because today's savings on health care, on child care, and other services for children, these are so short-sighted. They will cost us hugely in the long term. In bigger emergency room bills, in more homeless people, elderly shoved out into the streets, and as I referenced to David Brooks, a whole new class of criminals, a whole new group of people who, given support from the state that they need during critical stages of their lives, would allow them to hew to the straight and narrow. And if you're a single mom with two kids and they take away child care, you cannot work. And then they put a ceiling on how long you can receive welfare. At some point, you're going to choose the interests of your kids over whether you broke the law in stealing dinner for them tonight. So here are the cuts. Again, approved only by Democrats in very ugly procedures in Sacramento. $151 million in savings to the state achieved by increasing the Medi-Cal copay for hospital admissions to $200. $172 million saved by a 10% reduction in what the state pays Medi-Cal patients at long-term care facilities. $567 million from a 10% reduction in what the state pays to physicians, which means fewer doctors will choose to see Medi-Cal patients, meaning that those services will be unavailable to many of the people who need them. And where do they go? They're going to go to emergency rooms. Here's a $45 million savings from a cap on Medi-Cal visits to doctors, a maximum of 7 per year unless otherwise medically necessary. Well, I consider this a meaningless effort because doctors will say that the visits are medically necessary. And maybe a few hypochondriacs won't go to the doctor. We'll save a few bucks, but not even the $45 million that is projected. Here's $140 million in savings by increasing copayments on prescription medications. Now, for you and me, if we're working, that might not be so bad. But if you're on a fixed income, disability, Social Security, that could be the difference between taking the medications you need and saying, oh, I'll just take them every other day. $30 million saved from an increase in premiums and copays, elimination of vision care in the Healthy Families Program. Here's $568 million saved by a broad cut to services for the developmentally disabled. That means we're just saying that families who have children who are developmentally disabled are on their own. No help from the state, cutting back on in-home services, on transportation for the disabled. Think what that means to families you know with a person with disabilities living at home. Here's a $486 million saving, reductions to the in-home supportive services. It's an alternative to nursing home care, which means that many people will be forced into nursing homes at state expense because we've cut the in-home services. $90 million projected savings from eliminating adult day health care programs, which provide rehabilitation and social activities for elderly disabled people. Now, maybe you think they don't need social activities. I'm sure at Republican bridge clubs, that's what they're saying. Here's $5.8 million projected savings from a reduction in the medical supply stockpile and mobile field hospitals for major public health emergencies. Yeah, we have a major public health emergency. More people will die. And a lousy $6 million at the most would be saved. Now, here's the big one. And I have to disclose a potential conflict of interest here. $1 billion has been grabbed from the first five agencies at the county and state level. And my bias, my disclosure, I have for the last 8 years produced two radio programs that are funded from the tobacco tax, which flows to the first five agencies. And they just grabbed $1 billion from some of the critical programs aimed at early childhood. And this is what I commented on with David Brooks. His book, The Social Animal, gives serious credit to the efforts to reach people in the very early stages of their childhood development. And California has just said, we can't afford that. And the studies that preceded the passage of the tobacco tax that funded the first five agencies showed that you have higher rates of incarceration, of school dropout, and of criminal behavior when you can't intervene and support development in the critical first 5 years. So just project forward 20 years and consider the children born in the next 5 years. And we will see this cutback play out as a great expense to the people and to the quality of life in California. One more in this category, $152.8 million in savings projected from a new Medi-Cal copay for physician and clinic visits of $5 per visit. You say $5? Not a big deal. What about the mom who has to choose between $10 worth of gas to get to the clinic or not going at all? I know at the legislative level that tossing around a copay of $5 seems pretty inconsequential. But when you have nothing, or when you're living from a $150 paycheck to another $150 paycheck, these take on much greater significance. And the haves who make the rules, who make these budgets, are pretty far out of touch with the have-nots. There are three more categories here, and I hope you're still with me. In welfare and child care, we're cutting welfare grants for families by 8% to save $300 million, reducing welfare limits from 60 months to 48 to save a lousy $171 million, reduce all state contracts for child care, including preschool, by 15% to save $267 million, eliminate some child care services for 11- and 12-year-old children to save $38.5 million. Well, there's a group who will be breaking into houses and doing other juvenile adventures, maybe getting into drugs. Is it worth $38 million to a state with 33 million people? About a dollar a person? I don't think so. And finally, saving $109 million, reducing the state reimbursement for child care by 10%. Now, when I look at those, I say, well, at least they didn't eliminate the programs altogether. That's the difference between Democratic budget cutting and Republican budget cutting. But it still hurts the most vulnerable in ways that some will not recover from. The other cuts are pretty straightforward. $500 million each from the University of California and the California State University System. $1.5 million from the Hastings College of Law here in San Francisco. They must have had some cash in a safe somewhere. And an increase of $10 per unit for community colleges to generate $510 million. I'm not happy about any of those cuts. They are disinvestments in the future of this state and our competitiveness. It also forces these universities to deny access to residents of the state of California so that they can get foreign students and those from other states who are willing to pay full freight. And it is a rejection of the vision of Jerry Brown's father, Governor Pat Brown, who helped build and expand the California universities with the idea that they would always be affordable to virtually every resident in the state. That's a quaint concept now. And finally, to save $30 million, we're going to eliminate one firefighter and reduce from 4 to 3 the number of firefighters on CAL FIRE engines. Those are the people who respond to wildfires, forest fires. I'd like to see an insurance company step up and say, you know, this is a really stupid cut. And so Allstate is going to give the state $30 million to keep those firefighters on duty. They're going to close state parks to save $11 million, and they project $30 million by eliminating state funding for state and county fairs. And I still think that's probably penny wise and pound foolish, but it doesn't pain me the way these reductions in health and human services and welfare and child care do. So that's the state of affairs here in California. It's ugly. It's getting worse. And the Republicans continue to obstruct any meaningful effort to deal with these budgets in ways that are humane to those who need state services the most. And now, the latest scintillating commentary from comedian satirist Will Durst.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a quick take on the new political paradigm. Us versus them. Say what you will about the Democrats, for the most part, they actually believe, deep down in their hearts, that impoverished kids enrolled in Head Start programs can contribute to society and make the world a better place to live. For all of us. And they want rich people to pay for that. Republicans think these kids should pull themselves up by their bootstraps the way they did when Daddy gave them their first oil well. These basic attitudes stem from deep-rooted philosophical differences. The liberal idea is by helping the greater good, it'll eventually come back and benefit everyone. While conservatives believe exactly the opposite, that by helping themselves, it'll eventually come back and benefit themselves. These days, you can pretty much divide Republicans into three groups: the greedy, the mean, and the stupid. They live in a black and white land where compromise is defeat. Of course, liberals can be distilled into three groups as well: the pompous, the weak, and the stupid. Their world is a rainbow of colors where everyone is given a big box of crayons and allowed to write on the walls to express themselves. Liberals aim to further the brotherhood of man, while conservatives know this mythical brotherhood is just another left-wing conspiracy trying to separate them from their money. Another thing is the two sides are playing under entirely different narratives. Liberals behave like bureaucrats at a folk fair, trying to choreograph the welcoming dance of converging cultures, while at the same time Republicans are lighting torches and running towards them with pitchforks. There's a war going on out there, but only one side seems to know it. Might take a sharp poke in the side to wake the Democrats up, but even then they'll probably be more concerned with trying to raise pitchfork safety standards. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Hey, thank you, Will. Thank you, David Brooks. And thank you for listening. I'll look for your email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.